I've had the days where you make $500,000 in one day, right? Yeah. And the feeling I get from my son smiling up at me is better.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a podcast episode for you today. Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast, the show that helps you get rich, happy, and free with a capital F in your life and business. The show title on this one's pretty insane, right? This guy doesn't make $1 million a year. He's able to save $1 million per year in cash, after tax, after expense. And that's none other than my buddy over in Seattle, Mr. Todd Baldwin. Todd's a Seattle-based real estate investor who makes $15,000 per month in passive net cash flow, not gross, net cash flow from his multiple co-living properties. And Todd also specializes in luxury wholesaling in that same exact market. So the first half of the episode, we're breaking down how Todd took down, underwrote, and financed each one of his properties, how he manages the co-living situation, how he actually supplies everything from a weekly maid service, a community Netflix and Hulu account, and toilet paper and toiletries for the entire property, for all of his properties. We discuss how he screens his tenants and how you can implement this strategy in whatever market you're in, because Seattle's a very expensive market and he still was able to pull this off. Then in the last 20 minutes, we talk about how Todd is able to make hundreds of thousands of dollars per transaction through his luxury wholesaling operation. This is a fantastic episode all the way through. And before we jump into it, I have two things for you. The first is, I'm not going to do this show for free anymore. You know, I'm giving you guys a lot. You know, you need a little something back. It needs to be a reciprocal relationship. So I'll tell you what. I will get these multi-millionaire entrepreneurs and I will give them to you for free. My one ask is that you take this show and you share it with one person that you think would get value from it, or share it on your social media. Just help me grow the show. That is my one ask. And now for our last piece of housekeeping, I am reinstating our 15-minute freedom calls. So I am committing 2 hours per week to have a free call with any of you about any part of leaving your job. If you need help scaling your real estate, if you need help creating your vision, figuring out your goals, 15-minute call, I will do 8 of those this week per week. So that's 2 hours per week. I am making a contribution goal. So if you're looking to be job free in 2023, give me a shout. You can book in the link in the show description. Now, without any further ado, Mr. Todd Baldwin. Todd Baldwin, we finally made it, brother. Finally made it. How are you, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing great. It had been a long time coming. Sorry for pushing it back. With the arrival of my son, I've been swamped, but I'm glad I was able to make time today.
Yeah, I mean, I was laying in bed the other night. I had a tear roll down my cheek thinking that you put your newborn son over me. Frustrated, to say the least, but it's okay. It's all right. We'll make it through. But man, congratulations once again. 8 months old now. So you have been going through a transition and this is your first, correct?
This is my first, yeah. And I better get used to it because my wife wants to have 3 more. Yeah, so we'll see how that goes.
So the journey begins.
So yes.
Before we get into your real estate, man, you've been knocking it out of the park. You're one of the cash flow kings when it comes to maximizing cash flow on properties, which we'll get into with your co-living strategy in the back half of the episode. First, I want to talk, life is easy until you get punched in the face, right? So now you got an 8-month-old that you can't punch back. That'd be frowned upon, right?
Yeah, so, I'd go to prison.
Yeah. So walk me through the transitions that you've had to make in your life and your business now that this has happened in your family.
Being a father is the greatest part of my life. There's no question about it. I love spending time with my son. And I've had the days where you make $500,000 in one day, right? Yeah. And the feeling I get from my son smiling up at me is better. It just, and that's for me. I know that having kids and raising a family isn't for everyone, but I truly love it. And I feel really blessed that I've been able to build a real estate empire, so to speak, that has allowed me to take as much time with my son as I want, because I don't have to go to a job every day. But yeah, being a father is great. I will say it's a lot of work. Maybe this is TMI, but like, I haven't showered in 3 days because I just haven't had the time. I need a shower and a haircut. Yeah, you smell me through the computer. Yeah, and I definitely need to go to the barber and get like all the things, right? So it is exhausting, but it is well worth it. And someday it'll get easier.
All right. So ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to this, you're thinking about having kids, but you want to maintain your fade, watch yourself. It's not worth it.
That's right.
I love hitting on this aspect before we get into the dollars and the data, because the reason that I do all of this and the reason that I build everything that I build is because I had the opposite in my upbringing, where my father and I don't talk. He's never been in my life. So he was an air traffic controller. He was highly paid, made $167,000 a year. I looked it up through public record years later because we never knew. Even my mom never knew how much he made. And he was just always coming home super late, just did not. It would go into the garage and work on his stuff. And then he was just not there for anything. And it was just my mom there for everything. And so I was just like, man, like, what a shitty existence that is. I don't want that when I'm a dad. And so it's currently I'm single right now, but it's just like I'm in that period where I'm like, hey, I'm looking for my person. I want to have, you know, the kids and everything. And that's why I do everything, is so I could be that dad that's at the ball games, that's at the dance recitals and everything. And like, I want to be there for everything. So is that kind of how you're feeling too, man? Because you seem so excited and it fires me up too.
Yeah, I do want to watch my kids grow up. I don't want to miss that.
Yeah.
The days are long, but the years are short. I can't imagine. It's crazy to me that my son is already 8 months old, because it feels like he was born yesterday. And I know I'll be saying that probably for the rest of my life. Yeah, I want to be very involved in my kids' life. I want to be active in their hobbies and their sports. And I'm excited for that. How, if I can ask, how is your relationship with your dad now? Have you guys like reconciled and you've told him like how that made you feel?
Still non-existent, man. Like, we had an adult conversation. We went golfing last year. That's the first time I'd seen him in 9 years. And when we went golfing, I just told him like man to man, I was like, this is how I feel. And then he just straight up told me, he's like, I never wanted to be a dad. He goes, really? He's like, I just never wanted to do it. We just thought it was the right thing to do. And I respected it. Mm-hmm. I respected it. Like, he just had a very crappy upbringing. Mm-hmm. Like, for him, the upbringing he gave me was very tame. So right. It's like kind of ending these cycles of generational just terrible parenting. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to be able to do this. A question that I have for you, and I think it's going to hit home with a lot of the listenership here. A lot of people build big old cash flow businesses with their real estate investing. Maybe they have thousands of doors, thousands of units, all these Airbnbs. But then one day they look up, they have the new child, they have this family that they're already growing, but they're not spending time with them. And all of a sudden it's just, I'm doing this work for my family, is the singular cause that they're not spending time with their family. So before we get into like the cash flow, how have you designed your business to allow you to have more time and more headspace with your child or with your wife as you're making this transition?
Yeah. So I designed my business to pretty much be able to run on autopilot without me needing to be too involved. It took years to make it so it could happen that way. You know, I was working when I first started, I was working about 17 hours a day to get things going. And so I was working a ton up front. But at the time, I didn't have any kids and my wife and I were just dating at the time. So now that I'm married to her and I have my son and we're going to have a lot more kids, I do want freedom and time to be with them. And then the other part of my business is wholesaling. And with wholesaling, I basically only take on deals that will be very, very large transactions. So I don't need many of them to make it worth it. Like, I had a deal last year where, gosh, I think I literally made like 170 grand in 3 hours. And so it's like, you don't need too many of those to make it a great year. And you just spend the rest of the time with your family. So yeah, just designing it like big transactions and then passive monthly income so that it doesn't take a ton of my time or effort to go make a living.
So my understanding of that would be, if I were to give advice to a newer investor, I would more so probably focus on building up that underlying cash flow so that they can only focus on the big hits with the wholesale. Mm-hmm. Agree with that? Because otherwise, absolutely, you'd be taking everything that came across your desk.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to eat and you got to pay the bills and stuff. So yeah, if you can build up a monthly cash flow that's completely passive, then that gives you the freedom and flexibility to do whatever you want. And it doesn't have to be millions of dollars. Like, I think people, they get tricked by what they see on Instagram and the private jets, and most of that's fake anyway. But you can live a pretty awesome life if you're making 5 to 10 grand a month passively. Like, even 5 grand a month passively, that's not that much money. It's 60 grand a year. But if you don't have to work for it, you are wealthy because you have time freedom to do what you want. You can travel, you can do all these fun things. And there are people that maybe make 200 grand a year, but they're working 90 hours a week. I would rather make 60 grand a year and work 0 hours than make 200 grand a year and work 90 hours a week. That's just me personally, but I think that's a better way of life personally. Yeah.
I don't really understand how people spend a lot of money. That sounds weird because I'm friends with a lot of like deca millionaires. And the only way that I really see is just like big house, big car, like big country mm-hmm. club membership, like the big fixed expenses that are recurring mm-hmm. is like, yeah, when you have a $20,000 a month mortgage, that'll do it. And mm-hmm. then you have 3 Lamborghinis and like Rolls, then yeah, maybe that's another $10,000. That kind of debt adds up. Mm-hmm. You don't have that kind of debt. For me, I've noticed, I just literally traveled around the world. I tried to bankrupt myself. I damn near gave it my best shot. Right now in July, when I was in Greece, I was covering me and my girlfriend at the time, and that was $27,000. But besides that, about $10,000 a month is like living. It's like pushing the throttle. That's in a very nice hotel and apartment, like traveling, eating out every single day. And dude, that's just 10 grand a month for that. And so I'm push the governor up to 50K a month. I don't even understand how you spend it. I don't get it. Do you? I don't get it.
I think the difference is perhaps the stuff that most rich people spend money on doesn't appeal to me. And it sounds like it doesn't appeal to me you either. I have a friend, a real estate friend, who just spent $70,000 on a watch, and it wouldn't do anything for me. I don't even wear a watch.
Like, all right. So on that note, yeah. I hear where you're coming from. I'm picking up what you're putting down. I'm starting to change my thoughts on this. So I have a lot of friends with Rolexes now, and how they view them is they're like, this is a value reserve. I can put mm-hmm. $20,000 into this watch, and I can have that survive inflation. That makes a little bit more sense to me. But the cars, the hedonic adaptation, it just doesn't. It's just a never-ending race, man.
Yeah, I think if you can buy, if your hobbies hold their value, then that's awesome. It just, if I had to choose my buddy who spent 70 grand on a watch, if I was like, okay, I can buy the $70,000 watch, or I could with 70,000 buy, I don't know, 10 chickens and 3 cows and have a little farm that produces something for me, I would rather have the farm. Now, I'm not saying you can buy a farm for 70 grand. I have no idea what a farm costs.
Hey, I can tell you, you could buy a 7-month trip around the world for 73,000.
I would rather do that. Yeah. Now, I will say, because my wife and I are building our dream house right now. And one of the things that we're building, I've wanted this since I was 9 years old, is a home arcade. So I did just drop like 10 grand on a full-size Jurassic Park arcade machine, but that's going to be really fun. So it's like, I just spend money on things that appeal to me, and a Gucci belt or a nice watch just doesn't appeal to me. Neither does a Rolls Royce, but I'll spend money on things that I enjoy. I enjoy building businesses more than I enjoy having trinkets or, you know, whatever.
Let's get into business, man. Let's get into your journey. Let's get into the co-living properties, because you are a freaking cash flow machine for people that are listening to this that want to leave their job. I can't think of a better strategy than what you did and how you systematized your properties. So I do co-living myself, but it's more so like yours is on steroids. So I'll just let you tell people where you're at today and then just back the story up, and then we can walk through the trilogy here, man. But I'll let you take the floor.
Awesome. Yeah. This all started because my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, we were going to live together for the first time ever. And we were going to go rent an apartment in Seattle. That's where we live. And we found that for a 1-bedroom, 1-bathroom apartment, it was like $2,500 a month. No utilities were included. And you had to pay extra for parking. And we didn't want to do that. And again, like I had a six-figure salary. I was working in sales. I was making commissions. My girlfriend was making really good money too. And even we didn't want to do that. So we decided to buy a house and we didn't need all that space for just the two of us. So we opted to rent out the extra bedrooms to our college friends. And we had the rooms rented out in the weekend. So we were living in a six-bedroom, four-bathroom house that we owned, but we were living completely for free because our rooms that we rented out paid for the mortgage, taxes, utilities, all that stuff. And then 9 months later, we were like, we had the opportunity to buy another house because we were saving so much money by living for free. So we bought our second house 9 months later, and that was rented out within 5 days, all six bedrooms. That's when we realized there's a business to this. So we just kept buying houses every between 12 and 18 months. And at a certain point, we got up to six houses. We were bringing in like 40 grand a month in rent total. And then after all of the expenses, because we paid for a maid service, we stocked the house with supplies, we were making like 15 grand a month in purely passive cash flow, which on six single family homes, that's pretty unheard of. A lot of people invest in real estate where they buy a $300,000 house, they rent it out for 800 bucks a month, and their cash flow was like 150 bucks. We were making 15 grand a month in pure profit. So that was amazing. And it was pretty much untaxed because of depreciation. So after that, I started wholesaling and that took way off. And that's when the income started making millions of dollars per year. And now here we are and we have a son and we don't have to work and we're basically retired at 30. So it's been a crazy ride. And I think it's a great way to get started.
All right. So off of six freaking houses and some wholesaling.
Yeah.
You're off to the races.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, man. So I did a hybrid of that strategy. So I did the house hack strategy. So I was buying 5-bed, 4-bathroom houses. I'd live in one part, rent the other parts out. So the first one I rented the upstairs as the 3-bed, 2-bath as one unit, just as a traditional 3-2, like one level unit. And then the bottom I live, I moved a buddy from college into one of the other rooms. So it was like a co-living situation. That one, yeah. And they printed out and I did it again. And then so those print out about $4,000 in cash flow. But for me right now, I had a bunch of CapEx just happen. So I'm refilling all those CapEx accounts. So all the excess cash flow, I'm putting right back into the operations account. So that's super fun. Even though you put like your 200, your 10%, 15%, sometimes it's just like when it rains, it pours, man. But yeah, so let's walk through the strategy itself. So we just went over it in the macro. So in the micro, let's walk over this cash flow and break that down for these properties. So how did you manage so many people living in these properties? Because I know you had some systems around it that were very...
Yeah. So it started off with just me living in a house, having roommates. That's how it started. And that's probably the easiest way to start. And if anyone listening doesn't have a house yet, but you want to own property, in my opinion, that's the best way to do it is you buy a house for you to live in, primary residence, you can put a lower percentage down, get a better interest rate. You live in the master bedroom, let's say, and then rent out the remaining rooms to your friends. That's the best way to do it, in my opinion. If you can't handle roommates, then get a duplex or a triplex or even a fourplex and then live in one unit, rent out the rest. But anyway, so micro level. So I was just living in this house and I had roommates. And from that experience, I learned what works and what doesn't work because I was living it. So
correct.
What I found was that if you have roommates, for example, that are sharing a bathroom, and one of the roommates is always buying the soap and toilet paper, but you have a different roommate always using it up and never reimbursing, eventually the roommate buying all the stuff is going to get pissed off and they're going to want to leave because who wants that? So I made a decision to stock all the supplies, toilet paper, hand soap, paper towels, dishwasher pods, all that stuff. I just stocked it. I got it at Costco on a delivery. It was pretty cheap and it made it so for advertising purposes, I was like, your monthly rent includes all of the stuff, basically. Also furnished all the houses. We have a housekeeper come through once a week and clean the entire house from top to bottom because the number one roommate dispute is mess. So if there's no mess to fight about, then there are less overall fights that are going to happen. And then we did things like trying to match people by personality. But if you want to go to bed by 9 p.m., it doesn't make sense if you're in a house where everybody else wants to party till 2 o'clock in the morning. So being able to scale that and seeing if somebody applies for a specific room in a specific house, but they'd be a better fit for one of my other houses, I would just tell them and I'd have that conversation. And they appreciated that because they didn't want to be the odd man out. And as far as like how I managed everything, it's just what I was doing was so niche that I didn't think I could outsource it to a manager. And maybe I was wrong about that, but because you're not just dealing with tenants, you're dealing with roommates and personalities. And so I had deal breakers. What are your deal breakers? What can you not handle? And I wouldn't put them in houses with people who would behave that way. And then this may seem controversial today. It wasn't 5 years ago when I started, but I had one house that was all female because there were women that didn't want to share a bathroom with men. And so I had an all female house and I had an all male house and I had four mixed houses, I believe. So just doing stuff like that and making it as seamless as possible, I think has really helped me grow.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Like personally, I'd want to live in a dude house. Like that's what I would want to do. And I would imagine, especially if you were like the demographic that's looking to rent these places is probably somebody that's new to the area, just moved there. They just got a job. And if I was a woman, I don't know if I would necessarily want to live with a bunch of strange men that I didn't know. That completely makes sense. And you had optionality, so knock it out the park. Was this via like a Google form? Did you have a software you were using? Walk us through this template system. Were you like, how does this application look? What's this process look like?
Yeah. So I was super basic. I didn't take advantage of a ton of software. So I would basically, how it started is I would
advertise. Do you party?
That's right.
Do you party? No? Okay. Lame. Nerd. Right. The nerd house.
Exactly. Yeah. Go to the square house. No. So I'd have advertisements of the rooms, whether it's on Craigslist or Facebook groups, like Facebook housing groups. Or there was a website called Roomie that specifically is for finding roommates, stuff like that. So I'd have the listing. Somebody would respond to that listing. And, I forgot to mention, I would have a video tour on that listing as well. So they could take a video tour of the entire house in addition to pictures. So then someone responded to that listing and say they wanted a room. I would tell them specifically what rooms were available in that house. And then I would basically send them over the background check, which I used a company called Smart Move TransUnion. Most people don't use that, and most people use apartments.com, but Smart Move TransUnion is what I liked because it did credits, debt to income ratio, criminal history, if you've ever been evicted or not, stuff like that. If the background check told me decline, that would pretty much be the end of the conversation. I would then tell them if you have a problem with this finding, then you got to take it up with Smart Move. If it said approve, then the next step would be I do a FaceTime tour, and I didn't want to invite people into the house yet before actually meeting them, at least electronically, like we're doing right now or with a FaceTime. So once I did a FaceTime tour and they liked what they saw, then I would send them over the lease agreement and the house rules to look over. If all that looks good, then they could come over and actually see the house in person. When they saw the house in person and they saw the room, made sure they liked the vibes and everything, that's when we would talk about, okay, so what do you look for in a roommate? Like, what do you want to be your living situation to be like? You know, what is important to you? And if everything checked out then, at that point, we talked about signing the lease and putting down the deposit. So there were many steps to choosing someone. Part of the reason too that I did the FaceTime tour, part of the reason that I had the video tour is I found out the hard way that a lot of folks will no-show. So before I had videos of the properties, I would just go post up and I'd have showings back to back for different people lined up every half hour. And a lot of them just never showed up. And maybe that's a generational thing. Maybe young people are more, about ghosting people. But I had people no call, no text, just not show up. And so I was like, screw that. I'm going to have a video tour of every house so that they can go see for themselves if they like the vibes and the layout and this and that. And then if they actually do see that, that's when we can talk about coming and seeing it in person. So it evolved from there. And then, of course, we supply all the stuff, all the utilities. So water, sewer, garbage, cable, internet. There's a house Netflix account, a house Hulu account, all that stuff. So all utilities are included. And then all of the paper products and soap and stuff, that's included as well. And so I wanted to make sure that living with a roommate is not for everyone. But if you're going to be living in a house with a bunch of roommates, it was a no-brainer that you would be coming to me for that. So I wanted to give the best possible product and service for the niche that I was serving.
Nice. So you had an entire experience mapped out. Did you have a brand behind this, or was this just like your properties?
Just my properties. Yeah, it was nothing fancy. I'm just a guy with a couple of houses.
It's just too easy, man. All right, cool. Yeah, normally you would make something cutesy and they would take some vowels out of a letter, vowels out of a word and make it something cute. Roommateready.com or something like that.
But that wasn't me.
Yeah, no, I like it, man. You just executed. You got that action muscle. You got that dog in you. I love it. So you have all these people that have got this elevated experience. So obviously that's who you're catering to. What demographics were you catering to? Like more of a mid to high level income earner? What were you looking for in a tenant that you were trying to appeal to in your marketing?
Yeah, most of my tenants by default were young people just because that's who's okay with living with roommates. So most of my tenants, I would say, were in their mid-20s. Yeah. And a lot of them had really good careers, but they were saddled down with a bunch of student loan debt and wanted to live as cheaply as possible so they could pay off that debt and then buy a home of their own. So I had people making six figures renting a room in my house for $900 a month. And I don't know where most of your listeners are, but if that sounds expensive, Seattle's crazy. I was getting $1,300 a month for master bedrooms in these houses, which might rent an entire house in some places of the country. In Seattle, that wouldn't get you anything but like a crack house. So I was being able to price these rooms pretty good. My average room was about half the cost of a studio. So if my average room was $900, it's because studios in the area were $1,800 plus all the utilities. Sure. But yeah, one of the guys that rented from me was literally an astronaut, worked for NASA, making a ton of money. And then I had a lot of people from Amazon, a lot of tech people, because again, Seattle, I had people in the medical field making six figures. And then some folks had average incomes, and this is the only thing they could afford. But I would say that most of my tenants were young professionals trying to make and save a lot of money. And so living in a shared housing situation was a benefit to them.
Yeah. And how you were positioning it was for that tenant. You're like, hey, look, like this is a luxury thing. That's going to be my next question is how did you position the rent as opposed to a traditional market rent? Because you have all these amenities included.
Yeah, really, I just tried to make it so that my average room was half the cost of a studio. And then if a room was smaller than that, it would be priced lower. And if a room was bigger than that or had its own bathroom, it'd be priced higher. But most of my rooms on average were about $900 a month. And studios in the area at the time were $1,800. So I thought that was, and then, but yeah, as I said, I mean, I've had units go, every master bedroom was getting about $1,300. I also had a couple of Airbnb units too. And I was just trying that out. And now in my duplex that I live in, currently I live in a duplex and I rent out the other half as just one unit because it's only two bedrooms. And I thought we might as well just put a couple in there or whatever.
Sure.
But yeah, I wanted my pricing to make sense so that my average tenant could be saving about $1,000 a month if they rented from me, but then also have all the utilities included. So again, making it for the right person, making a no-brainer.
Yeah, a win-win. Wait, so you took down the first property, kind of like traditional financing. How did you finance the remaining five properties? Because if you're making six figures, but like how much were these houses? How much were these acquisitions? And how did you do like a DSCR for the remainers or how did you do it?
No, it was pretty much all traditional. So yeah, my first house was $506,000. I was a first-time home buyer at the time, so I got away with putting 3.5% down and moving in. And then for 9 months, I lived for free. I lived for free for longer than that, but it was 9 months till I bought the next house. I was living completely for free in a house that I owned with a very nice salary. So I bought my second house 9 months later. That was, I believe, $525,000. I did have to come up with 20% down for that, but just because of the nature of my job, having a six-figure salary plus commissions, and my fiance at the time, again, now my wife, but she was working too and had a good salary and we were living for free, coming up with that 20% was possible for us. So we did it. 6 months later, we bought our third house, which we actually moved into. So we bought another primary residence. We were no longer first-time home buyers at that time. But being that it was our primary residence, we didn't have to come up with a full 20% down for that third house. So I think we put 10% down on a third house, which I believe was $540,000, something like that. And then I think an entire year later went by, we bought our fifth house, or I guess that'd be fourth house. We bought that also as a primary residence with 10% down. That was $624,000. But then 2 months later, we bought our fifth house, which we had to put 20% down on. That was $770,000. And then 18 months after that, we finally found this duplex, which was 900 grand. We moved into it. So it's our primary residence and our down payment was 90,000. But we were able to scale so quickly because we were saving 100% of our salaries because we were living for free and the cash flow was nuts. On our first house, we were living for free, but on our second house that we ever bought, our cash flow, I believe, was $2,500 a month just on one house. Yeah. So all of that money, we were just stocking away for the next house and just basically doing a big snowball.
Man. Okay. Dear God. All right. There we go. He just bought a freaking house a year, basically.
No, yeah.
That's awesome. So how are you guys? So how much were you making on the salary? Because even at 200, after my second house, they were starting to tighten up on me with how much I could take under my name.
Yeah.
I was making like a $250,000 and I was getting tight, like the conventional loans, the conventional mortgages were starting to tighten up on me. But that was also as a single dude.
Got it. Yeah. So my salary at the time was, I believe, 150K, yeah. But I was a salesperson. So I was also making commissions. So like there would be days where I make 40 grand in commissions. So my income from my job was good, but also maybe it was different on your end, but my mortgage broker allowed me to basically count my rental income towards my total income and then offset my expenses. So like when he looked at my debt to income ratio, he looked at, okay, I live in this house. The payment's 3 grand a month, but my roommates pay me $3,200 a month. That completely offset. So it was like, in his mind, I didn't have this debt of 3 grand a month. I had this income of 200 a month because I was collecting $3,200 in rent. I had a really good relationship with my mortgage broker who like understood it. He fundamentally that's understood huge, what yeah. I was doing. I think that's probably rare to find. I think a lot of banks have their algorithm and what they go for and this and that. But my guy was just really on top of it. I never once had to start a company and put it in the company's name. Like all of the mortgages and stuff were always in my name, which maybe is not the smartest way to do it. I know a lot of people would have LLCs and stuff, which I do. I just never found that I needed to use it because I have insurance that would take care of most of that stuff anyway. But yeah, we really never had a problem getting financed.
Okay. Yeah. Because right now I would basically have to go the DSCR route because I left my job a year ago, like this week. Still mm-hmm. working the W-2 or are you out of that now?
No, I retired from my W-2, I believe in 2019, September of 2019. But now from the last couple of years, I've made well over $1 million in profit from wholesaling and stuff too. It's not getting financed for the next project, certainly isn't a problem. I think this is actually, last year was the second year in a row, I made enough to actually save $1 million. So like, it's one thing to make $1 million. And then, yeah, and then pay 400 grand in taxes. So you're left with 600 to live on. But I made enough to actually put $1 million in the bank. That has been super lucky. And I can't believe it got this big and crazy, but it's been good. It's been good for sure.
Screw the co-living. Screw all that we just talked about. Let's talk about the wholesaling. What the hell? Okay.
Yeah.
So walk me through this. What are you wholesaling?
Very high-end luxury properties in the greater Seattle area that are huge transactions. Now, I will say I wouldn't have been able to start a wholesaling business as successfully as I did had I not first built up a reputation in real estate doing the room rentals. Because let's say I'm going to wholesale your property. You're going to Google my name. That's the first thing you're going to do. And from my success in doing the room rentals, there's a dozen articles about me in real estate. I've been on CNBC. I've been on the news. And so anyone who I was going to do business with for wholesaling, they could immediately look me up and know that I'm legit and not a scammer. So that was like a huge, just great blessing for me because they know I'm real. So once they get, you know, that out of the way, oh, this guy's a legit guy. He works in real estate, blah, blah, blah. Then I could have a door open for me to do wholesaling. My first ever wholesale deal, I made 50 grand in one afternoon. And that's when I realized, okay, this is awesome. Basically what wholesaling is, I'll tell you how I do it. And then I'll tell you how most people do it.
I was about to say, because this isn't normal. Right. I've got a buddy, David, that makes, he probably makes 600, 700,000 in Kansas City. He had an institutional buyer. He would just funnel the properties towards them. But now they paused buying with all this bank stuff and all this economy stuff going on. So that's why I'm interested.
Yeah. So I'm very particular about the deals that I take on. I only work in high-end luxury deals that are going to be huge transactions. So the first house I ever did a wholesale deal with, the seller of the house wanted to sell his property for 800 grand. he did not want to list it on the MLS with a realtor. I don't know why. And I told him, I was like, you sure you don't want to just list this thing? And he was like, no, I don't want to list it on the MLS. I want 800 and I don't want to pay a commission out of my 800. And so I said, okay, what if I sell the house for you, but instead of taking a commission out of your 800 grand, I'll just try to raise the price. And if I can raise the price, I'll keep the delta. If I can't raise the price, then I don't make any money. So the example that I gave him was like, what if I raise it to $810,000 and I keep the 10 grand, but you still get your full 800? Is that agreeable to you? And he said, yes, absolutely. So we agreed that anything above 800, I would just keep, because all he wanted was 800, but he wanted to get that full amount and not pay commission from it. I was able to raise the price to 850 grand, find a seller, sign the contract, and get it to a title company. It took me 4 hours to do that. So I made $50,000 in 4 hours of my time. Now, again, that's because 6 years prior, I had started buying up real estate and building an investor list. This doesn't just happen overnight, right? Like, I have an investor list of 15,000 people on it, of people who want to buy, flip, rehab real estate. So when I had someone come down the pipeline of, hey, I have this house for this price in this area, I knew exactly who on my list to send that to. And boom, within 4 hours, we put a deal together and I made a ton of money. And my next deal ever, I made 100 grand and it took me less than a week. That's when I started doing wholesaling. I won't say full time because I only do around 5 transactions per year because I'd rather just hang out with my family. But I make sure that those transactions are very high end. And the reason for that is I had somebody ask if I could sell their property for them who certainly was not a rich person. They were probably middle class at best, maybe working poor. They just happened to have this condo. And the condo was $300,000. And I was like, I gave my whole spiel. Okay, I will have to raise the price. They had a problem with that. They were like, well, if you raise it to $310,000, I feel like I should get $307,000 and you get $3,000. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was like, that's just not really worth my time. Like, I can, not when I can take my time and make 100 grand or 50 grand or whatever. And we kept going back and forth. And finally, because they weren't rich, they were a teacher. I was like, okay, I'm just going to help this person out. For whatever reason, they don't want to list it because they want to pay commission, which I think is lame too, because sometimes a realtor can get you even more than you ever were expecting. But I agreed. And after several weeks of going back and forth, they just pulled the deal. They're like, actually, never mind. I don't want anyone to make any money from my house and I'll try to do it myself. Now, they weren't able to sell it themselves. They weren't able to do that. But so I had someone freaking out about the idea that I might make $3,000 to $5,000 from their property. And with my high-end clients, I had people happily paying me $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 to do all of the work for them. So it was completely seamless. And so I was like, screw the other thing. I'm not even going to do that. Solve rich people problems. They pay better. And so I was just like, I'm going to go ahead and just do the high end stuff. And that's been a game changer. I haven't looked back since.
Yeah. A good example of this is I just hired my first juicy coach, 50K for a business coach. Cause I always ask the question, like, what does the 8-figure version of me do? What's the 8-figure version of Brian do? And so like when I was picking out my apartment in Austin, Texas, cause I was in Atlanta and I came back from traveling and I was like, okay, where would I live? Like, where would that 8-figure guy live? Like, where would he live? And I was just like, okay, now that I've ate the shit for a couple of years, lived in the basement of my house hack, like I've earned the right to upgrade because you earn the right to move to the next level. And so I was just like, downtown Austin, like that's where I want to go. So I came here and I got this place and I hired the coach. And then he was like, all right, it's 50K. I'm like, whoo, that's a lot. I was like, I don't have that sitting around in cash casually. I was like, I basically seller financed my coach. And I was like, hey, how about $100,000? It's like, I'll give you $100,000, but the contingency is my goal is to get this up to $1 million a year business. And so for you, I was like, I'll just give you 10% of gross revenue paid out in 4 quarterly dividends. And so then our interests are aligned and you make double.
And he's beautiful.
Like, yeah. He's like, yeah, let's do that. So I'm like, yeah, I'm paying double, but it's just now I've got somebody that's even more in my corner because the faster we get to a million, the faster he gets his 100,000, which is double that his going rate. And it's just solve rich people problems. So what's cool about this, and I think it's a good lesson to learn, is everybody talks so much about like how to flip the property, how to do the co-living strategy you did, how to, they'd get lost into
okay, what were the logistics of you ordering the toilet paper and all that type of stuff? But that's not the answer. The answer was like, how did Todd build his brand? How did Todd build his credibility? How did Todd build his reputation? How did Todd build his skill sets to where they compound on each other, to where now 4 years later, you could be able to make $100,000 in 4 hours? Mm-hmm. That's the question to ask, mm-hmm. because like now it's the same thing with this podcast. Like I keep doing this podcast, next year, hundreds of thousands of people listening per month, then I can be able to do the same thing. And it's just like, that's why I was able to build a 100K business in 10 weeks. So it's just,
no, 10 weeks, 4 hours. There's levels to this. It's insane.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's insane because I remember thinking back to my first like 100,000 that I made in a year. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. It's the mountaintop. Mm-hmm. And then there's just so many different levels, man. It's so interesting. What do you look for in a property? What's your buy box? What's your buy criteria? Because normally in wholesaling, you're finding really crappy properties with problems. Like you're buying problems and you're selling them to investors to do like a flip, a fix, and then do a value add. So for your high-end luxury properties, what are you looking for?
Yeah, completely the opposite of what most wholesalers look for. The properties that I typically don't need any sort of work, the last one that I did was a multi-million dollar house that when the owner of it just looked at what the commission would be, let's say the commission on this house, just for sake of argument, would be 200 grand. If I can do the same thing and he only has to pay me 80 grand, then
it's a win.
So for them, that's great. And then for the buyer, it could be good too, because if the seller, let's say the seller is going to save $220,000 because they're going with me instead of listing it, then maybe they give 50K off the asking price to the buyer. So the buyer is getting a deal because the buyer is getting it for potentially 50K below market. And the seller is getting a deal because even after that discount and paying me, they're saving 200 grand or whatever it is. And that's typically what I do. I know most people who host wholesale try to get a house well below market value and then assign it to an investor who's going to go fix and flip it. That just hasn't been my strategy. It's not that it doesn't work. I'm sure that does work very well. I just knew that I wanted to work with, frankly, just very wealthy people in high-end real estate. People that aren't going to freak out about the nickels and dimes and worry about just get the deal done. And if it's a value that they're going to have no problem paying me my fee, and it's worked out wonderfully.
There you go. So what's the cash flow looking like today?
Oh my gosh, it's so much.
Yeah, I guess you have the wholesaling is like over $1 million, but what about the co-living?
So are you talking about just like the profit from that?
Yeah, net take home from the monthly from the co-living.
Net take home after all taxes are said and done, right around 15 grand a month.
Okay, and that's even after tax. Yeah, you don't really have taxes because you do the depreciation and everything. Okay, so 15 grand in passive income coming in per month. That is 180. Yeah, sorry. I'm not as good at math as you talk. Come on. Yeah, 180. So 180 in passive income and then a couple men, probably like 1.5. Oh my God, dude, you're killing it. All right.
Thank you. Sweet. Yeah.
That's why we do podcasts, man.
There you go. Yeah. And even if it was just the 180 in tax-free income, that would be awesome.
You're already good. Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that it's been able to bank, like actually make enough to save a milli the last couple of years has been nuts.
Yeah. So long story short, ladies and gentlemen, build your brand, build bankable skill sets, and solve rich people problems.
That's right.
Head off into the sunset.
Boom. Dude, exactly.
I love it, man. Where can people find you?
Yeah. If you guys want to follow me on Instagram, and it's just at Todd J. Baldwin. I used to have a YouTube, but I recently got shadow banned. We'll skip that for now. Yeah, I got shadow banned. But Instagram, if you guys want to message me, go ahead and at Todd J. Baldwin. I'll hopefully get back to you and answer your questions.
Heck yeah. You guys heard it here first. Check out Todd. And then what market are you in again?
Seattle.
Seattle. There's a bunch of Seattle listeners for Action Academy for some reason. There's 900 of y'all. So shout out to Seattle. Yeah.
Nice.
So apparently you'll have a lot of people that probably reach out to you. So there we go. Sweet. Seattle peeps, reach out to Todd Baldwin.
Awesome. Thanks,
man. I appreciate you. Thanks for coming on, brother.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Todd and Brian with the Action Academy podcast, signing off.
Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with the show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are 2 main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 or 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.